I call this meeting of the House Education Finance and Policy Division to order. Members, please take your seats. We do have a quorum, and if anyone's had time to review the minutes, and I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Thank you. Representative Bang approves the minutes, or moves to approve the minutes. All right. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for February 26, 2019 are approved. So today we have a special presentation from the Office of Higher Education. We'll be discussing the governor's budget, and we have Commissioner Olson. Mr. Olson, welcome to our committee.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. For the record, Dennis Olson, Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education.
And you may proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Today we appreciate the opportunity, Madam Chair and members, to outline the budget for One Minnesota on behalf of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education and all higher education investments included in the governor's budget proposal. And Madam Chair, before we proceed, we do have quite a bit of content in our budget presentation here, our PowerPoint, as well as numerous testifiers testifying on behalf of some of the targeted program investments. And so I would ask what you prefer in terms of questions, whether we wait until all total testimony is complete or during the presentation.
Well, members, I think given the time that we're at the beginning of this, maybe if there seems to be good stopping points when we've covered a topic, maybe we can take questions then before we proceed to the next testifier, if that seems appropriate for you, and we'll see how the time goes.
All right.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Thank you. So, Madam Chair, members, Minnesota is a leader in post-secondary education and educated workforce. We know that college completion is more important than ever for three key reasons: to meet Minnesota's changing workforce needs, to address Minnesota's post-secondary equity gaps, and to ensure the economic security and well-being of all Minnesota residents. However, college feels out of reach for too many of our Minnesota students. And these challenges must be addressed. We hear from students, from higher education leadership, the cost of college is a real concern, as well as student debt. And of course, attainment gaps for students of color and indigenous students are of utmost concern. I will just add, this morning we convened our attainment stakeholders group, our attainment report stakeholders group, and we really talked about those gaps and the importance of shining a bright light on those gaps to make sure that we're targeting investments to close those gaps. And so we appreciate that work, but it's fresh in our minds this morning. So Governor Walz has proposed an umbrella of investments in programs, mainly in three areas. Number one, to increase affordability. Secondly, increase access to and completion of post-secondary education training. And then increasing readiness for college and career. And finally, maintaining critical infrastructure. And Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan yesterday outlined the capital investment proposal, the bonding proposal, including additional investments for higher education. And so that's a critical component of this overall investment. The total investment by Governor Walz's proposal is an increase of $157.54 million over the biennium for higher education. This represents a 4.8% increase over the base. And these investments are spread across the three budget areas of higher education. Firstly, to the University of Minnesota system, an increased investment of $39.18 million, which represents 3% over the base. For the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system, $51.6 million increase, representing a 3.6 increase over base. And for the Office of Higher Education, $66.75 million, representing 13% over the base. The first area we want to discuss, and Madam Chair and members, as you can see, I have with me members of our team from the Office of Higher Education, and Meredith Fergus will be going through some of the state grant investments, but our first area of target is affordability, which includes building a strong foundation with the Minnesota State Grant Program.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Meredith Fergus. I'm the Manager of Financial Aid Research and the State Longitudinal Data System for the Office of Higher Education. So the Governor's recommendation for investment in the Minnesota State Grant Program is significant. It represents new appropriations of $54.167 million for the biennium, 14% over the base. It does increase the average state grant for all current recipients, just approximately 81,000 students, by $300. And then it increases and adds eligibility for 4,700 new students who will likely receive a state grant, with the majority of those students being at the Minnesota State Colleges. You should note that with the many questions about free college, and as our last presentation noted, that this will actually ensure that Pell Grants and state grants cover 100% of tuition fees for full-time students for families making up to $45,000 a year if they enroll at Minnesota State Colleges or Minnesota State Universities. The also increased state grants will also serve 500 students currently not receiving Pell Grants, because they are ineligible for federal student aid. We firmly believe that the governor's budget will increase the chance of success in education and work for lower and middle income students in Minnesota. In fact, 38% of all state grant recipients are students of color or indigenous students. There are five components to the governor's state grant recommendation, and the pie chart on the side of the chart shows you how new funds, that $54 million, is actually distributed. In addition to the $54 million in new appropriations, the changes actually also allocate $20 million in unspent funding within the state grant program, anticipated to be unspent next year. The first component is to increase the living and miscellaneous expense allowance currently, and I'll go into more detail on the following slides. The second component is to decrease the assigned family responsibility in order to buy down the burden that middle-income families face when paying for college. Thirdly is to fill in unawarded Pell Grants for underserved students, students who do not currently qualify for federal Pell Grants. To add a child care pilot that would actually cover child care expenses as a supplement to the state grant program, specifically the living and miscellaneous expense allowance. And better communication. We know a lot of students are not aware about how much college costs or how much the state actually gives out in grants to students who are lower and middle income. And so the office firmly believes that doing a better job of actually informing students and families about how the state can help them on their college pathway is critical for our long-term success.
Ms. Ferguson? Or Fergus, excuse me. We do have a question if you're willing to stop at this point. Representative Boldenut.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Commissioner and Ms. Ferguson. First, I do want to thank you for your investment in the state grant program. My wife was able to attend the College of St. Benedict through that grant, and that's where I met her, so I'm glad that was available to her. My question is, with this investment in the state grant program, the budget leaves Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota no option but to increase tuition. So I just wanted to know how those tuition increases would impact the value of the investment in the state grant program.
Madam Chair and Representative, the state grant spending projections was not built on a tuition freeze assumption. In fact, the spending projection assumed that Minnesota State would increase tuition 2% across both years of the next biennium. And so that is already built into our calculations for the state grant spending. In addition, at the University of Minnesota, we built in a 2% assumption in each year for the outstate campuses and a 3% assumption for the Twin Cities campus. So those tuition increases, when tuition goes up, the state grant essentially design splits that tuition increase between the state and the student. So for each dollar tuition increases beyond this year, the state pays 50 cents and the student pays 50 cents. So if tuition were to go up $200, The state grant would increase $100, and then the student would be asked to pay the additional $100. Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, just a quick comment. Thank you, Ms. Fergus. I just want to express my concern that with the underfunding of the institutions, that the new investment in our state grant program would be insufficient to cover the tuition increases. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
You may continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The first component, this is the more detailed slide, is to increase the living and miscellaneous expense allowance. Currently in state law, it is set to 101% of poverty guidelines for a single individual for a nine-month period. We would ask to increase this to 110%. And we ask for that increase specifically so that students can have a minimum standard of living, which we do expect to be a frugal standard of living, but also have additional resources to pay for necessary books and supplies without having to compromise food or housing security. It's very important that we recognize that there is a base kind of living standard that we do need students to maintain, and books and supplies are needed on top of that. This element would actually cost $25 million in new funding for the biennium, and it will increase the LME just so from $9,422 next year to $10,262, which is an $840 increase. Students, if they are full-time, would see half of that increase reflected in their new state grant next year, so an increase of $420. Across both full-time and part-time students at all institutions, it averages out to a $200 grant increase. And there are 3,000 new students who become eligible for a state grant once that change is made. Under the second component, the assigned family responsibility, the governor recommends reducing it by 6 percentage points. The assigned family responsibility is essentially the percentage of income that we require families to contribute to the cost of college. And that would be parents of dependent students or the student and the spouse if they are an independent student. By lowering that, we are actually helping low-wage working adults and middle-income families receive additional state grants to help pay for education, which reduces their need to borrow and work. This element of the proposal costs approximately $26 million. Recipients will see an average increase of about $100, and it adds 1,700 new recipients. And we've included what the modifiers in state law would be changed to under this proposal. Across just both the LME and the AFR changes, we did some visualizations for you. So the green bar represents the Pell Grant projected for next year. The blue bar represents the state grant under current law with no changes. And the orange and the red reflect the changes from the LME in orange and the red from the AFR. So you can see students at all incomes will see an increase from the LME change, and then as income goes up, we see that the red portion gets slightly larger. So that is where the $54 million is concentrated. And this is specific to students at Minnesota State two-year colleges. We also added visualizations for students at Minnesota State universities using the same kind of proposal, with the green representing Pell, blue the current state grant with no changes next year, and then the orange and the red reflecting the AFR and LME changes. And finally, the University of Minnesota, also Pell Grant, state grant, and then the new added changes from AFR and LME. Just to give you a better sense of exactly which incomes those changes are being concentrated on. The third element of the governor's proposal is a fill-in for unawarded federal Pell Grants. Currently, federal financial aid policy makes students without a high school credential and non-citizen students ineligible for Pell Grants. Because the state grant formula in state law assumes that all students do receive a Pell Grant, we actually subtract out that amount even if the student doesn't receive it. So that would essentially force students to limit enrollment, borrow more, or work more in order to fill in that missing Pell Grant. The governor's proposal would amend the state grant award calculation to discontinue the subtraction of the unawarded federal Pell Grant for those groups that were deemed ineligible, students without a high school credential and non-citizen students. It costs approximately $2.2 million for the biennium, and it affects approximately 500 students each year. And the grant amounts being compensated for are the Pell Grant amounts, so they would range from $100 to $6,195. The fourth component is essentially a pilot program for including child care expenses as a component of the state grant. We currently have a Minnesota post-secondary child care grant. However, that program is underutilized because of the complex award formula. And so we are actually thinking of, we would like to simplify that program. And one recommendation from our institutional staff is that we administer it as a supplement to the state grant. So we are asking for authority to administer child care expenses as a component of the state grant, specifically within the living and miscellaneous expense allowance. So students with children under the age of 12 or special needs children under the age of 14 would have an increase to their LME reflecting their child care expenses, and then the state grant formula would be calculated and then would increase based on a proportion of those expenses covered. This would allow the state to actually spend out more of its child care and actually enroll more eligible students and make accessible child care options available more broadly, thus allowing students to take more classes, reduce their work, or otherwise maintain their current post-secondary education pathway.
Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Fergus, why would it be that the child care funding was not used and is still available? What circumstances, you know, caused that?
Madam Chair and Representative, so the current child care grant award formula requires that you demonstrate that you are under a percentage of poverty. You also have to provide verifiable child care expenses. If you have, say, for example, $3,000 of child care expenses, it only actually covers a portion of the cost. So we'll subtract out, it will prorate the amount by whether you're full-time or part-time. Then it will subtract out additional components. It's a very complex formula that really we should remedy in state law. We did try to spend out the existing, currently it's about $6 million a year. We currently spend about $4 million of that, and this is after increasing eligibility essentially each of the last three biennia, as well as adding graduate students as eligible students to the program. And so it seems that simply increasing eligibility is not helping us spend it out, that we actually need to simplify it and make it more broadly available. In addition, colleges are actually subject to verification as well as auditing on the program, and because it is a complex formula, we find that colleges where they are subject to some errors in the calculation actually choose to opt out of the program. And so we're trying to kind of find the best of the situation. And so,
very good. Thank you.
I also have a follow-up with that, Ms. Fergus. Could you tell me how much is available then that you'll be carrying forward or carrying over from previous allocations?
Madam Chair, we're not asking for an increase in the child care grant program. It currently stands at just over $6 million a year. Mm-hmm. We anticipate that next year we will spend between $4 and $5 million of that. So and OHE typically in session law is granted transfer authority to move unspent funds from year one into year two. Mm-hmm. So this would allow us in year two to actually administer the pilot using those unspent funds from year one.
Okay. All right. And may I ask one more follow-up? I'm not getting the gist of it, of what you're simplifying, mm-hmm. that you think more people will be able to access this program that have not in the past. Right. And if you could address that again, mm-hmm. thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair. So currently we have to take the student's income and recalculate it as a percentage of poverty. Then if they are under the allowable percentage of poverty, we identify what their total child care expenses are. Mm-hmm. We can then modify the child care modify the allowable expenses by if they have an infant versus an older child. Mm-hmm. Then we have to prorate the entire budget by their enrollment level. And then there's probably two more steps that we have to do to get to the actual grant amount, but the grant is actually not awarded until the student shows verification and documentation that the expenses were paid. Mm-hmm. And we require, because this is a decentralized program run by colleges, not centrally at the office, we actually require colleges to have providers sign a verification form, which documents how much the student is getting and how much they expect to be paid. And we find that informal providers, such as family members, neighbors, those kinds of how we say, more inexpensive forms of child care that students may rely on, mm-hmm. we're having difficulty getting those provider forms filled out. Mm-hmm. And so there's a number of steps in the process that seem to be slowing it down, mm-hmm. yes.
And in the future, what will the process be?
Correct. Madam Chair, we're hoping to centralize administration through the state grant program formula, as well as meet with institutional representatives to actually define a better verification process for child care providers that takes into account the more informal nature of those family members, neighbors, and other inexpensive child care options.
Okay. So to some degree, this is to be developed.
Correct, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Thank you. Please proceed.
And, Madam Chair, I should mention that I believe the language that MMB is looking at for us would ask for a study in year one to document underutilization, the complexities, mm-hmm. and then make recommendations for how to change the program and provide the chairs with written authorization before the pilot was implemented.
Thank you.
The final component is the communications campaign. Again, we would like some additional communications activity to inform students, working adults, and families about expected costs and eligibility for a variety of grants. Currently, the office under state law focuses their communication efforts on high school students and their families. And so we would actually like to expand what we do and do some more social media, more up-to-date technological innovations about getting the message out, about how much college costs, and how much the state provides to individuals who may be eligible for the variety of grant programs we offer. This would require some redesign to our websites, as well as additional email, social media, and print materials. We are specifically looking at programs in other states, such as Tennessee, which have actually provided training for staff at schools, businesses, and community organizations to kind of distribute that message out there through a more informal grassroots network across the state. And so we're hoping to be able to apply that model to the variety of state grant programs at the office.
So, Madam Chair, the second area of investment focuses on access and completion. These access and completion investments include boosting college completion for returning adult students with the Minnesota Reconnect program, as well as expanding Earn While You Learn training grants to employers via the dual training grants. And you'll hear a little bit more through personal testimony afterwards.
Madam Chair and members, Minnesota Reconnect is a new program that was actually established in partnership between the Office of Higher Education and Minnesota State. The impetus for the program was research done in conjunction with the state's educational attainment goal. We collaborated with a demographer and were able to document that approximately 10% of Minnesotans aged 25 to 44 started college but dropped out with a credential, no certificate, no degree. That equates to approximately 138,000 individuals in this state. What we, Minnesota Reconnect, aims to do is we aim to help adult learners re-enroll and complete their post-secondary education. And to do this, we're modeling off programs in Tennessee and Indiana, which looks at dedicated advising, financial assistance, and improved campus services for adult learners. And we currently have funding for the campus service and the dedicated advising components of the request under a grant from the Lumina Foundation, and that grant will actually end in August of 2019. We are asking for an additional $8 million, which includes added financial assistance components, so scholarships, which will help serve 1,000 students. The current version of the program is focused on Minnesota State two-year colleges, and it started this year. It launched this fall with four campuses, and it specifically targets colleges who have a demonstrated commitment to adult learners. Currently, our participating colleges are Riverland, South Central, Inver Hills, and Lake Superior. And even though we don't have a scholarship component, we have so far been able to enroll 174 students to come back and finish their degrees. Dual training grants is our other program, and that is more of an earn while you learn program. And it's actually targeted at employers who want to help develop their workforce while employees earn a paycheck.
Representative Dang, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just going back to the last slide, just wondering, how do these colleges participate in the Reconnect program? Is it an opt-in process, or what is that process like?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Representative Vang, I missed the last question.
Is it an opt-in process? Like, if they want to be a part of that program, they just apply for it, or what is that like?
Madam Chair, Representative, we actually had a competitive application program. So we knew based on the grant that was awarded to Minnesota State in our office that we could actually fund four positions, dedicated advising positions at four colleges across the state. So it's a one FTE at each college. We, in collaboration with a committee, developed a grant application, and the colleges then applied. And it asked a lot of questions about how had that, what policy, procedural, and structural changes had they made to accommodate adult learners' needs, such as our campus service offices, the business office, financial aid, career services, are they open evenings and weekends? How have they implemented prior learning assessment? How do they work with students to ensure military credits transfer? So we asked a number of questions that were geared at policies towards adult learners. The committee then scored the applications and chose the top four institutions. We do anticipate continuing a competitive process, given that we think that focusing on colleges that have a demonstrated commitment provides our basis for success.
May continue. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, the second program, the Earn While You Learn program, is the dual training grant program. You might remember this as it was proposed under Senator Bonoff, and it is aligned with the pipeline program. The dual training grant program is the grant component to employers, and it targets them so they can develop their workforce by providing their employees access to funds for skilled training while they are employed. It is limited to four key industries, which are in state law: advanced manufacturing, agricultural, healthcare, and information technology. What we are asking is that for additional $2 million for the biennium, for two areas. One, employers are finding that sometimes training is quite a distance from their employment location, and so students may need to travel to receive training, stay overnight in a hotel, have meal expenses, and other travel-related costs. So we're asking for a small increase in the grant amount to cover those education-related travel and housing costs. In addition, we're asking to expand the pool of money available to employers in advanced manufacturing. That is one industry area where we're seeing high utilization, and many of the employers have actually asked for additional grants. The dual training grant program provides up to $150,000 per grantee, which would be the employer. It is limited to approximately $6,000 per student or employee. We would be asking for an additional $1,500 per student for those travel and housing costs. So far to date, they have awarded 112 awards to employers. 67% of the awards actually go to employers in Greater Minnesota. Among those 112 awards, it actually represents 67 individual grantees or employers across 41 legislative districts. To date, there have been 913 students awarded, and this does include training not only at a college or university, but a private training provider, specifically if it's a technical skill, and so we have 42 related instruction training providers. 75% of all students who receive money are actually current workers, incumbent workers, who were employed for at least a year prior to participation in the program. So it really is focused on helping current employees develop their skill sets that their employer needs. And after exiting the program, 93% of all employees are still employed with their employer following program participation at 1 year.
And Madam Chair, members, the third area, college and career readiness investments, include preparing underrepresented students for college and career through increased investments in the intervention for college attendance programs grants, as well as limiting summer melt for low-income students through the summer academic enrichment program.
Madam Chair and members, the first program is the Intervention for College Attendance Program. This program is actually a long-standing program in the state of Minnesota, and it provides grants to programs that foster academic success and ensure underrepresented students are prepared for college and career. Kurt, we are asking to increase the base appropriation by $336,000, which would be a 25% increase. This would be the first funding increase for the program since 2008. The goal is to reach more students and target specific high-need student populations, and it would help our programs deepen services to grant recipients, and our program providers are nonprofits, post-secondary institutions, school districts, as well as professional associations. We have included detail on how many grants are awarded between currently. The program averages between 18 and 24 grantees per year, and it serves between 2,000 and 4,500 students. You should note that students who participate in ICAP program do graduate. In the four-year high school graduation rate averages about 90% as compared to the current statewide rate of 82%. In addition, among ICAP participants, approximately 90% enroll in college as compared to the statewide rate of 70%.
Ms. Fergus, do you also have information on graduation rates then in college for this cohort of students?
Madam Chair, that's a great question. I believe we do, but I would have to follow up with the program manager on that.
Okay. And then also part of that, too, would be the years it takes, how long it takes to graduate, if it's on-time graduation or if there's additional time.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the second program is the Summer Academic Enrichment Program. Many people don't know that the Office of Higher Education operates this program. It is we note that summer vacation often takes a toll on students' knowledge or skills, specifically around math or science. So the Office of Higher Education provides grants to students from low-income families who are vulnerable to that summer melt to allow them to attend an achievement program during their summer vacation. We would ask for an increase of $250,000 for the biennium. The average scholarship per program participant is $878, and this would allow us to fund an additional 250 students approximately to attend those summer programs. Last year, 801 students were served, and just so you know, 100% of them are free and reduced price eligible, and 69% of them were students of color. The grants were to students at 35 programs across 14 sites, with the vast majority focused on science, in addition to communications, language arts, fine arts, performing arts, as well as social studies.
And finally, Madam Chair, maintaining critical infrastructure was a priority of Governor Walz's investment proposal. So the infrastructure investments include expanding a statewide longitudinal education data system, SLEDS, and the Early Childhood Longitudinal Data System, ECLDS.
Okay, and if I believe we have another question from Representative Rumbach.
Yes, Ms. Fergus. So the number of students in the college summer academic readiness or whatever, it's a small number. So how do you spread the money across, you know, and then pick, and so who gets it and who doesn't, I guess?
Yes. Madam Chair, that's a great question. We do fund on a first-come, first-served basis among the programs that operate that. Just so you're aware, this program actually only has a base appropriation of $125,000. However, because it is a small program, OAG can utilize its current transfer authority to transfer unspent funds from other financial aid programs into this one. And so it allows us to kind of bring up those award amount or the number of students we can serve each year by utilizing other unspent funds. We do have a variety of programs that do apply to be participating in the program, and we typically figure out in approximately March of each year how many programs are interested in receiving funding for their students. But the funds are allocated on a per-student basis, so we are limited by whatever is available by the time the program begins in about June.
And Madam Chair and Ms. Fergus, these are high schools then we're talking about. Is that correct? This is where all this summer program, enrichment program, that's all high school?
Madam Chair and Representative, the students are K-12 students, so they could be, I believe, 5th through 12th grade, but they are actually served by other programs such as Concordia College or other kind of academic enrichment programs in their communities. And I believe Ms. Grimes would like to add to that.
Madam Chair, some examples of some of the programs.
Ms. Grimes, if you would identify yourself.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you.
Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education.
Thank you.
Some examples, these are for 3rd through 12th graders, and some examples are Best Prep at St. Cloud State and St. John's University, Carleton College, Concordia College Moorhead, Health Force Minnesota, which has what they call Scrubs Camp, which involves Augsburg, Rochester, Winona, and St. Paul, and the University of St. Thomas. Those are just a sampling of some of the programs that participate.
Mm-hmm. Representative Roman.
Thank you. That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Madam Chair and members, the critical infrastructure component of the OHE budget would be the state longitudinal education data system, as well as the early childhood longitudinal data system. We are asking for an increase of $2 million to the biennium. These systems are central in measuring outcomes of Minnesota students, as well as the performance of state-funded programs. So this data flows into the Minnesota Department of Education's report card for their college-going rates. It flows to DEED for calculation of employment outcomes of college graduates, as well as WIOA reporting. It also flows into the Office of Higher Education for example, the Getting Prepared report, which is developmental education rates of current high school graduates. So it fulfills data needs for a number of state-mandated reports. In addition, it allows policymakers, educators, and parents to make informed decisions and allows us to identify barriers to education and employment. For the early childhood I should start with the state longitudinal education data system has been funded by the state since 2014. But the early childhood longitudinal education data system was funded under a federal grant beginning in, 2012. And that there were two federal grants, and the second federal grant is expiring on September 30th. So without additional state funds, the early childhood longitudinal data system would be unable to continue.
I believe we have another question here. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure to which testifier, but in regards to SLEDs, I'm looking at this, and it looks like there is some research, obviously, that this data is used, and I'm inquiring the data that is shared with potential third parties for research purposes, for example, or any other purpose other than any other third party, not limited to just research purposes. Do the people of which that information pertains to know that it's being shared with third parties, and do they have the opportunity to opt out, for example, and having their information shared with third parties?
Madam Chair and Representative Lucero, just to clarify, the third parties that SLEDS operates are typically professional researchers, faculty members who are studying educational attainment or employment issues, as well as state agency staff. Those requesters go through a very long process, which takes approximately 6 to 8 months for their vetting before we share any data with them. The data, however, comes to SLEDS via the Minnesota Department of Education as well as the Office of Higher Education and DEED. So we do fall under the State Educational Agency and the State Educational Authority statutes of FERPA, the Family Educational Rights of Privacy Act. And while many of our colleges do include SLEDS in their Tennyson warnings, I don't believe it's necessarily included in the K-12 parental notification, but it might be. I'd have to check with MDE on that. However, do I think they know about it just on their face? No. I don't think many parents, when they're signing their enrollment forms each year, actually think about SLEDS when they're signing that notification under FERPA. We do actually have outlined a process for opt-out in Minnesota, but to date, no parent or student has asked us to do that.
Representative?
How would you notify parents of their option to opt-out?
Both under Minnesota Government Data Practices Act as well as FERPA, both parents, if the student is under the age of 18 or a K-12 student, as well as students, are able to both examine their educational records as well as correct their educational records. We don't do any specific training ourselves other than what we rely on our educational entities to provide as part of just general data privacy to the parents and students. So I'm not aware of the exact forms or training that schools and colleges use. Yes.
Madam Chair.
More follow-up?
Yep.
All right. And so we'll check in on time at this point. Do you think we're still good? All right. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if you're not aware of any parents that have opted out or anybody who has opted out at this point, I would suggest that perhaps there has been lack of energy or effort in effectively informing parents of their ability, because I can't believe in the entire state of Minnesota that nobody's opted out if they are aware of their option to opt out. Mm-hmm. So back to my third party's question. So I believe you that you do a thorough vetting and the number of months that goes into before information is shared. But how about post-sharing of that information? Because this is going to contain presumably very sensitive information that is being shared with third parties that a person may not even know that their information then is being shared. After it's been shared, how often is it retained by those third parties, and does the department have you ever audited those technology systems of which this information is being shared with to ensure that its methodology of protecting the information is up to industry standards?
Madam Chair and Representative Lucero, I would add that the data that's actually in SLEDS is not personally identifiable in the sense that we have no names, we do not have a full date of birth, we do not include social security numbers or MARS numbers. So the data is actually what is called de-identified. That said, an individual based on their characteristics may become known. So you would, for example, a student may become known if you know them well and can identify what their characteristics are. We do require on the application form that requesters notify us of the IT data security and data privacy standards they utilize within their agency as part of maintaining security around the data we provide. All data is provided for a limited period, typically 12 to 24 months, at which time they must verify in writing to the office that all data has been destroyed. We do not currently go out and audit individual entities or faculty member computers, though. It is something we are interested in figuring out how to do, though, and so we have kind of started talking about how we would do that. And so we do anticipate, hopefully, that we'll be able to come to some resolution on auditing. Yes. And we're working across state agencies to figure that out.
Thank you. Also, Representative Vang.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious if the system right now does data disaggregation.
Madam Chair, Representative Vang, we do data disaggregation by special population, so they would be the common populations you see in K-12, free and reduced price lunch, the federal race ethnicity categories, so the seven categories of race ethnicity. We also do special education, limited English proficiency. On the higher education side, we do Minnesota residency, age, first generation, and veteran status. So there is some disaggregation allowable. And that data actually goes down to the individual high school or college level. And so within those subgroups, yeah.
Follow up. And does that include, is it disaggregated by ethnicity too as well?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. Both higher education as well as K-12 data does include race ethnicity. But again, we're limited to the seven federal race categories. So we do not have the level of disaggregation that MD is currently implementing. And so many of our, such as Asian subgroup populations, are aggregated together. It is something we'd like to rectify into the future. Yeah.
Thank you. You may continue.
Madam Chair, to wrap up, wanted to discuss the systems investments that the governor has proposed, both for core services at the University of Minnesota, as well as operating increases at the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, including the next generation technology investment request, and finally the capital investments. So for the University of Minnesota system, the governor's request supports education, research, and outreach at all five of the University of Minnesota system campuses, again reiterating a total investment of $39.18 million of an increase for core services for the biennium, which represents a 3% increase in the base. The capital investments outlined yesterday include a $28 million investment in bonding funds for the Child Development Building, replacement on the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. And we've often heard that building and that program described as a jewel of Minnesota and certainly a key research program for the University of Minnesota and for the state of Minnesota. In addition, a $4.3 million proposal for the renovation of the A.B. Anderson Hall on the Duluth campus, as well as a $117.7 million proposed investment for the Higher Education Asset Preservation Replacement, or HEAPR, funds.
Commissioner? Mr. Olson, I believe we have another question. Thank you. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Madam Chair and testifiers. Many of the people in this room may recall that when President Kaler presented his budget, I was surprised that it was as low as his budget was for the needs that many of us know the university has. So my question to you goes back to page 4. So when we're looking at the three budget areas for higher education, the University of Minnesota is getting 3% over its base. Minnesota State is getting 3.6 over the base, and the Office of Higher Education is getting 13% over the base. With the idea that we really hold the line on tuition increases for our students, can you please help me get my head around how these numbers were chosen? 13% over your base, but the others need so much less.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. Governor's investment represents a 2% increase year over year in both systems, which will offset the or help offset the inflationary costs. And last year in fiscal 18, inflation represented about 2.25%. And I will reiterate Ms. Fergus's note that the state grant projections do project a 2% tuition increase, as well as 3% at the University of Minnesota. And so if tuition was raised beyond those projected percentage points, the state grant would pick up half of that funding for students.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in my community, I represent Plymouth 44A. In Plymouth 44A, there are quite a few students who don't qualify for the state grant. And so when advocating for my community, I'm looking at these tuition increases and saying, this is a ton of money, and trying to go back and explain to them that, you know, the university only deserves 3% increase over the budget when they've been asking for money over and over. And what they're seeing and what they're feeling is that the family portion is getting larger and larger. And the state is supporting our university systems, whether you're talking about the University of Minnesota or you're talking about our state system, less and less. And I see more and more dollars going to private institutions and less going to our state institutions. And while I am getting my head around the fact that giving state grants to students who are part of our population who then take them to private institutions, I can understand to some extent. I cannot understand the neglect of our state institutions to this extent. And so that's where my question is coming from. And we are shifting the burden more and more to the families. There is no free lunch at the University of Minnesota or our state institutions. If we are going to continue to cut back the funding for the state institution in that way, in the base, the money has to come from someplace, and it's coming from the pockets of our citizens, and they are almost to a tipping point where we won't have to worry about whether we have grants or not. They won't be able to go. So it is a legitimate concern, and I want to register that with you.
Thank you. And any further comments in regards to Representative Claiborne's comment?
Madam Chair, Representative Claiborne, I would just clarify that the Office of Higher Education's $66.79 million increase, pretty much with the exception of SLEDS, $64 million of that actually does go to students and families, and so it will travel back to the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State as well. And so I do think it's important to understand that what OAG does is student-focused, too.
Madam Chair. Further comment, and I also know that Representative Wolgemont has a question to or comment at this point.
I'll just keep it really short to just say that we don't have to go zigzag to get money to families, right? We can do it directly by giving it to the universities and the state university system so that they don't have to increase the tuition in the beginning. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Representative Wolgemont.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, testifiers. I'd like to echo some of the similar sentiments of Representative Claiborne. I'm very proud to represent the students of St. Cloud State University and many of the faculty who work there. And one thing that I've heard from them loud and clear while having discussions with them in my community, and something that all of us have heard from presentations and testimony from students and faculty here at this committee, is a desire that as a state that we get closer to that goal that's outlined in statute, that goal that the state fund the cost of 67%, two-thirds of the education at a state college or university. Does this budget get us closer to accomplishing that goal?
And Commissioner Olson?
Yeah. Madam Chair and Representative, thank you. I had asked Meredith to, Ms. Burgess, to pull up an additional slide showing some calculations on where the governor's proposed investments will end up within the systems and within the University of Minnesota, as well as private nonprofit and private for-profit institutions. So I asked Ms. Burgess to walk through that, and I think that'll provide some clarity in terms of where we're targeting the funds.
And you want to point us to it?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, this is the last page of the PowerPoint. These were some extra slides we included. So this is simply a one-year reflection on change. So of those, remember, as I mentioned, there were the total state grant changes are actually $74 million. 20 of that is paid throughout of current appropriations, and then the remaining 54 would be new. Of that 54 million, when you split it by year, you can see that approximately $12 million in each year will go to Minnesota State two-year colleges, $7 million in each year will go to Minnesota State four-year universities. And so combined, that equates to approximately 53% of that $74 million in changes. The remaining 47% is split across the University of Minnesota at $7.6 million per year, Minnesota private nonprofit institutions at $8.6 per year, and private for-profit institutions at simply $1.5 million per year.
Yeah. And Representative Gomez, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, testifiers. I guess it's sort of just on the same point as far as the kind of different allocations for the three pots, as far the Minnesota state system, the university, and the state grants. I represent an area where there are a lot of low-income people, and so I'm appreciative of the increased investment in the grant program, which does have the income sensitivity built into it. What concerns me, I think, is the fact that, you know, the Minnesota state system serves students in my district a lot, and my understanding, at least, and you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, I'm kind of trying to like figure this out, right, is that the state grant program has both, like, it's calculated both on income and the cost of the institution, and so and that the, you know, the upper limit of the cost of the institution, sort of part of the formula, is pegged at the University of Minnesota's tuition. That's right. So I guess I'm just trying to kind of think, like, that a student who's a low-income student who decides that a Minnesota state two-year or four-year school is for them, because there's sort of like an opportunity cost in a certain way, like to putting the money in the state grants, you're not putting it in the Minnesota state system. And so, you know, I can't quite quote these numbers, but somebody sort of walked me through and said that they thought with this budget as presented that the Minnesota state system would be looking at maybe more of like a 7% increase in tuition. And so I'm thinking about that family that who's making the decision to go with Minnesota State, and the lack of investment in that system, and their choice, because it's the right choice for them to go to a lower tuition school, like that it doesn't offset it, that the Minnesota State grant investment maybe doesn't offset the lack of investment in the Minn State system that really kind of, you know, provides a sort of a blanket protection against really high tuition increases. So that's my concern. I mean, you can hear our districts kind of, right, have different sort of situations that our people are in, but I just wanted to throw that out there.
Madam Chair and Representative, we understand that absolutely. I did bring back the coverage chart that we had talked about briefly before, and you are right. So under the current state grant spending formula, we actually, even though we cover half of the tuition increases for students who are eligible for a state grant, you can see that for families who are earning above the what is the average income in Minnesota, which is about $65,000, they do have to pay some. They're not going to be qualifying for 100% of their tuition fees covered. And so we would love to get to a level where we are covering more. We are covering 100% of tuition fees for more Minnesota families. We also know that for each student we serve in the state grant program, that there is an upper income family who is not being served. We're very cognizant of that fact. But from our perspective, when you do have a limited pool of resources, spending $1 million across 1,000 students or $1 million across 10,000 students, you do have to make some tough choices. And so for this budget perspective, the governor chose to invest in the state grant program.
If I can follow up with the question and understanding from Representative Gomez, you talked earlier about the assumption being if that 100% of tuition for the lowest income families was built around the assumption of a tuition increase. But I believe you said it was either 2 or 3%,
right. So
and that now that we are, but, you know, from the data that we've heard from the institutions themselves, it's possible a tuition increase might be up to 7% just to keep level with what programming is right now. So the institutions would have, they can either cut programming and cut other places in the institution or increase by as much as 7%. So my understanding is that a 7% tuition increase was not one of the assumptions that you made in your grant program.
Madam Chair, yes. The initial spending projection utilized a 2% assumption. However, state law is written to actually calculate grants by on whatever tuition rate is implemented by the board or approved by the board.
Okay.
And so grants would go up even if the board passed a 7% rate.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And we have more questions. Representative in the vice chair.
Yeah, exactly.
Bernardi, thank you.
Thank you. I want to get to people who would like to testify in our audience as quickly as possible, so I'll be really brief. I just wanted to make clear that what I was hearing from what Ms. Fergus was saying, that this money on that page on 34 about Minnesota State grants, she was talking as if it was going to Minnesota State, as if it was going to the University of Minnesota. I want to make it clear, it is not, and can you verify that you meant that students that go to that school will be receiving them, but it does not go to the institution like how I heard it.
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi,
it
essentially, the grants are applied against the students. The student is charged tuition-free fees, and then financial aid is applied. The Pell Grant and State Grant are applied against charges by the institution, and so essentially only if the student has 100% of their tuition fees covered by another grant, such as the Pell Grant, would that funding go to someone other than the college itself. Yes.
Yeah. And Representative Poppy, you had a question?
No, Cleveland.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we would all agree that it's important to provide funding to students. We'd like to have students have access to more money because then they will hopefully be successful and be able to get through their college experience in the least amount of time, work less hours, and be able to not incur such a deep debt. But one thing I just want to stress is that there is a value to actually providing funding to the colleges and universities because they provide services that assist students to get through college in the least amount of time, get the courses that they need within the right framework, and be able to graduate and be able to find employment. And all of that is something that I know that it's important for students to get funds, but if we don't and aren't able to provide the services at the colleges and universities, we are not doing the students any favors. So just want to make that clear that I think sometimes you know, we might get lost and really, you know, it may seem as though we're not necessarily supportive of grants to students. I support that we would give students grants, and I know that we have private and public colleges and universities that we're talking about here, but when we're talking about the public institutions that we should be funding, I just want to make it clear that there's a value to that. There are services that get provided that assist students, and I don't want that lost in this discussion. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Poppe. And Representative Claiborne, you had a comment or question.
I would like to echo Representative Poppe's comments as well. And when we look at this last sheet, when we look at this back sheet, and when we're thinking about issuing grants to students to cover the cost of tuition, when we are letting those dollars that would have supported our state institutions flow to private institutions, we are also, in fact, starving our public institutions. So while I'm all about letting families choose where they want to go to college, I would say when I'm looking at numbers that say $8.63 million will be flowing to private nonprofit institutions and $7.65 will be going to the University of Minnesota, it seems to me that there's a disconnect as to what our initial obligation to our state with state dollars would be. Even though I understand that the students attending are citizens of the state, but I don't want to be funding private institutions at the expense of our public institutions.
Response, comments?
Madam Chair, Representative, I would simply state that the state grant program's allowance of choice with an institution type is set in state law and has been since 1983, actually probably 1967 when the program was first introduced. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I think you have testimony to complete.
Thank you.
And I guess one more question, if I... Sorry, I missed it. Representative Gomez.
Sorry, I'm just going to go back to the increase in tuition. So you said that the state grant allocation is sensitive to the increase in tuition that would be coming potentially because of the lack of investment in the Minn State and the University of Minnesota systems. So if Minn State has to raise their tuition 7 or 7.5%, then is it lagging, or would the allocations of the individual grants would change based on that this year, or would it drive money into the state grant program kind of as like an inflationary sort of thing in the next round? Do you know what I'm asking?
Madam Chair and Representative, the state grant is essentially tuition rates are set for classes that would start next year, so academic year 19-20. The state grant would adjust in that same academic year. So essentially those higher tuition rates would take effect approximately July 1st, and the state grant increases would also take effect July 1st. They're at the same time. Yes.
Madam Chair. When the state grant spends more money because tuitioning has increased more than we had originally projected, we make adjustments in other areas. We may have to slightly decrease what we would have otherwise had living in miscellaneous expense allowance be, or what we would otherwise have to slightly increase what we might have otherwise expected of families.
Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. At this time, I'd welcome up some testifiers to speak on behalf of the impacts of some of the targeted investments that Governor Walz has proposed. We have two testifiers on behalf of the Minnesota Reconnect program, Heidi Thury, the Minnesota Reconnect Navigator at Inverhills Community College, and Dr. Wendy Robinson, the Vice President of Student Affairs for Inverhills.
Welcome to our committee. Please identify yourself for the records, and who will testify first?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for having us. For the record, my name is Dr. Wendy Robinson. I'm the Vice President of Student Affairs at Inverhills Community. We were really excited about the opportunity to testify on behalf of the MN Reconnect program and to tell you a little bit more about the experience that our institution has had with this program. Inverhills Community College has been historically known for serving a lot of adult students and serving them very well. We're currently ranked 12th in the country for community colleges in terms of our reputation and outcomes for adult learners. Despite the fact that we already have robust services in place for adult learners, we still identify that we had too large of a population of adults who had some college but no degree. In fact, in the last 5 years prior to the start of this program, we were able to identify over 1,200 students who began with us, left our institution, but did not transfer somewhere else and did not earn a credential along the way. For those students, not finishing their college degree has significant economic impacts, especially those who took on student loan debt to fund their education. They are now obligated to pay that loan debt back, but don't have the increased earning potential that comes with having earned a college credential. So when the opportunity to apply for the MN Reconnect program opened up, we knew that we wanted to be a partner site and to be a part of this pilot program. Our population of adult students is large and historically very diverse, with 60% of our adult learners being first-generation college students, 40% are low-income students, and 35% identify as students of color. Our adult students who wish to complete their educations are generally balancing multiple priorities, family, work, school, other life circumstances, and face significant barriers to re-entry. They may be looking at how to have credit from prior experiences, how that will apply to their degree program now, may face financial holds from prior experiences within higher education, are looking to see if they qualify for credit for prior learning programs and have options for having their work or life experience help them earn credit toward a degree at our institution. And they may need additional services like evening support hours, online tutoring, ways of getting kind of holistically served as they are figuring out how to make coming back to college a part work for their current adult life. The MN Reconnect program has really aligned well with other valuable on-campus supports that we currently offer, including web-based tutoring, campus health services, including counseling services, emergency grants for students who are facing unexpected financial emergencies, a mobile food pantry and a food shelf on campus, additional support services for students who identify as having disabilities, students who are veterans or otherwise military-affiliated, and more. One of the things that MN Reconnect has really allowed us to do is to be holistic in how we serve students and give them a kind of one-stop shop, dedicated point of contact to help them overcome all of those challenges to reentry. And thankfully, I have my colleague here today who is that one-stop shop and that point of entry for our students. So I will turn it over to her.
And we'll pause maybe for a moment. And Representative Bernardi, you have a question at this point? Oh, okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Heidi Thury. I'm the Adult Student Navigator at Inverhills Community College. I've been in the role since we started the program in June of this past year. After our fall semester, we were able to enroll 63 students under this program. Three of those students did complete their degrees and transfer on to continue bachelor's degrees. Of the 60 remaining students, I was able to help retain 39 of those students who are now continuing their education with Inverhills in the spring semester. And for spring, we added another 65 students. So we currently have 104 students under this program at Inverhills Community College. One of the biggest barriers that we are seeing with our students coming in is financial. Many of them might be experiencing financial holds from previously attending school and are not able to rectify those holds and are not able to attend college. Some students are also finding other financial challenges, such as not being able to use or utilize as much financial aid. They might be limited in the amount of financial aid that they have left at the two-year level, as well as not being able to use any current financial aid to help them with any past due balances. Other challenges for these students is wanting to come back and complete their degrees, but then needing to make that life-work balance and family balance work for themselves. So reducing hours at work is not always possible for them to be able to finance their own education as they're moving forward because they have a family to support as well as themselves. Other life circumstances are coming up for these students in terms of trying to work through their educational plan and looking through what their previous experience can gain them. Some students have a lot of experience in areas, but unfortunately we don't have the opportunities to turn that into college credit. So working through each student individually is what I do. I'm their one-stop shop, and so any issues that a student has, they start with me and they end with me for the most part. So anything I can't answer, I reach out for them on their behalf. So we found that to be really beneficial, and most students really do appreciate having a point person when they're returning to college to help ease them in and make it very seamless for them. In your packets, you will find a letter from one of my students, Jonathan Quinn, who provided a statement for you. He was not able to attend today because he is in class, so I hope you will apologize for him not being here. But he does just talk a little bit about what his goals are and then also how the program so far has helped him out. He should be finishing his degree here within the next semester and be transferring on to his bachelor's degree.
And I'd just like to conclude by saying programs like MN Reconnect are not only really powerful and beneficial for the students who may get the assistance and ideally in the future additional funding through this program, they also make a significant impact on our institutions and on our state and local communities as well. Students who have started a college degree and haven't finished are at the highest risk for defaulting on their student loans. They also have limited employment opportunities because they haven't completed that degree. So the more students that we can help finish that what they have started and help them apply those credits that they've already earned to be able to have an identifiable credential and move on for their bachelor's degree is just a really beneficial for them, for their family, and for their entire community.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Robinson, Ms. Thurl. And other testifiers?
Madam Chair, members, thank you. And next, and we have one more program following this presentation, round of testimony. On behalf of the Intervention for College Attendance Program, or ICAP, Raquel Coolidge from Concordia St. Paul, Marshall Gay, the AVID African American Male Initiative. I'm sorry. Madam Chair, members, my apologies. We actually have dual training testimony next. Martin Asau, Jessica Lyons, Amanda Gregory, and Garrity Freeman from Design Ready Controls.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourselves for the record.
Madam Chair and Representatives, my name is Jessica Lyons. I'm the Human Resources Manager at Design Ready Controls. And I'll introduce my colleagues after I give my overview of our program. So Design Ready Controls is a manufacturer of electrical control panels and wire harnesses in Brooklyn Park and has been participating in the dual training program since 2016, and we're in the sixth grant round with the program under the mechatronics technician occupation. And we've had a total of 31 employees with various job roles and responsibilities participating in related instruction and on-the-job training, such as production technicians, engineers, and different leaders in our company. And students are enrolled in one of the following three programs of study: an associate's in the two-year automation robotics engineering technology program through Hennepin Technical College, a four-year bachelor's in applied engineering through Bemidji State, which is an online program and a two-by-two with the Hennepin Tech program, and a two-year professional science master's in engineering management through Mankato State University. And we've been able to take employees that come in with maybe entry-level skills, so different occupations like wire harness assembly or warehouse, and through the related instruction on-the-job training, elevate their skills to more higher-level positions like electrical manufacturing technicians. And our company plans on continuing to participate in future rounds of the dual training grant, as it's been critical to our success in developing skilled labor. We've been able to use the program with our partnership with schools like Hennepin Tech and offer classes on site. So a lot of the programs are tailored to employee students who have families or have barriers to continuing their education. And as we continue to grow as a company, we have the need to source for higher level technical positions and leadership. and our leadership team is looking to recruit from the employee students that are participating in the dual training grant. And so to date, 8 of the employees that have participated in the grant program have been moved to higher level positions in both our production and office areas. And this has been through a combination of the related instruction and on-the-job training. And so today, 2 of our employee students are here to testify to their individual experiences. And so I'll hand off to Gardy Freeman, who is participating in the 2-year program with Hennepin Tech.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Gariatu Freeman, and I work as an electrical drafter at Design Ready Controls Incorporated. And I have benefited from this program before. When I started at Design Ready Control, my background was in mechanical drafting and assembly. But due to the program, I have acquired my skills in electrical drafting and the robotics program. This program has benefited me because I am a mother and also a big sister to 2 little girls. And they look up to me for instructions. And for this program, it has helped me in a way that I'm able to save whatever money I could have used towards my education to support the family at home. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Martin Asau. I'm a project manager with Design Ready Controls. I've been with Design Ready Controls for 8 years. When I started, I came from an educational background. I had a Bachelor's of Science from the University of Minnesota in Environmental Science and Policy. Over the past 8 years, it's been kind of a wild ride, but the field that I've progressed into, my professional career, has changed. Starting in 2016, I was one of the original members at Design Ready Controls in the pipeline program and the dual training grant. I attended the Minnesota State University, Mankato, as part of the Professional Science Master's in Engineering Management degree. Through that degree, I've been able to adjust my skill set. I've learned new techniques, best practices, additional items that have helped me grow professionally and academically to support both myself and Design Ready Controls.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Commissioner Olson.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Finally, I'd like to welcome up testimony on behalf of the Intervention for College Attendance Program, or ICAP, Raquel Coolidge and Marshall Gay from Concordia St. Paul, the AVID program, the African American Male Initiative.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
So my name is Raquel Coolidge, and I have been a part of AVID for approximately 6 years, and I've definitely seen them benefit me in many ways. Especially senior year, I've seen that they've taught me how to take notes in different ways that other students haven't been taught. So in my more advanced classes, I'm able to annotate notes more and know how to break them down easier for me to understand, and that's not a benefit that kids in other programs weren't able to get. And also, I believe that AVID has held me to a certain standard that I do appreciate. If they see me slacking or if they see my GPA drop, they definitely give me that extra help to push me to go to college, so they know that the standards of college.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Marshall Gay. I am a junior at St. Paul Central. I've been in AVID for 3 years, but in the African-American lit class, or the African-American class, this is my first year. For the African-American class, I look at it like a brotherhood. You know, I have people to lean on and to talk to if I'm struggling with school or, you know, things at home. And I just feel like AVID is a place that, sorry, I'm really nervous.
you're doing great.
So I was starting off high school, I'm going to be honest, I wasn't on the right track. I didn't have my mind to get my mindset together, and specifically Ms. Shuley, the avid teacher, she has taught me, she has been there for me so much. She has taught me with notes how to do, like, how to actually take notes, right, and just... Avid is just some organization where, I don't know, like, they're just always there for you. They, and a lot of students need that, you know, it's, they need people to lean on, and Avid is a wonderful place where you could just be yourself and, just get help with whatever you need. Yeah, it helped me a lot.
And can we ask, would you share with the committee what plans you have for the future? Anything post-secondary college?
Well, I'm getting my list of colleges together. I know I'm little, I don't know what I want to go for, but I plan on most definitely following up with school and going to college.
Thank you.
And I plan on doing a 2-year and then transferring to Loyola University for my English teaching degree, because I definitely want to help out with our youth in the English department.
And you will come back to Minnesota afterwards.
And I don't know, this weather is kind of making me.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for joining us in the committee today.
Thank you.
Commissioner Olson.
Madam Chair, members, thank you again for the opportunity to share the Governor's One Minnesota budget on behalf of higher education. Of course, my contact information along with Ms. Fergus is up on the screen and available in your packets, and we do appreciate the questions and the many concerns shared today. And we will be sure to follow up and communicate with the Governor as well. The many concerns from the members, and make sure we get appropriate answers to the questions that were posed again today. So, Madam Chair, that concludes the presentation and testimony. If there are additional questions, otherwise, we can commit to follow up. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Olson. All right. Well, with that, we are approaching the 4 o'clock, and the committee is adjourned. Is that it?